Okay, thank you, Rachel. So last week, we saw one tool that Agata uses to add meaning, and that was the symbolic import of details such as names and numbers and objects. And we're going to move on to another tool Agata uses, and this one I think is thought about less, so it's nice to kind of put it on the map, as it were, which is the question of where stories appear. Because in theory, a lot of stories could have been placed in different tractates, in different mesechtot, and the editors of the Gemara chose where to place the stories. And one possibility, we're going to see this in a second, we'll see two perhaps extremes. One extreme is to view it as not that significant, meaning they just looked for any excuse. Let's say they had a great story about Rav Shimon Bar Yochai in the cave. If we could find some way to fit it in, we'll fit it in. Not that it has some deep connection to its context. Of course, the alternative would be that it was intentional. And if it's intentional, I just want to point out there's many layers. We could have it connect to the local sugya. I mean, whatever the Gemara was discussing right there is connected to the story. It could be connected to the larger chapter. Maybe it belongs to that chapter of Shas. It could be connected to the larger unit of the whole tractate, of the whole Masechet. So we're going to explore those two possibilities today. Is it more of an arbitrary placement, or is it a meaningful placement? And if it's a meaningful placement, how does that work? Okay, so as we did last time, I will mostly lecture in the beginning, although I'm happy to read the chat comments. And then at the end, we'll open the floor. Okay, so let us go to share screen. I think we should be ready here. Okay, excellent. And I believe Rachel also sent it out, if anybody prefers that. Okay, here we go. Wait, there are already two comments in the chat. Is that you, Rachel? Let's see. Yeah, they're both Rachel. Okay, fine. Okay, so now let us go to set up the dichotomy here. Okay, so we're going to go a little bit out of order. I'm not sure why I always make a source sheet and then sometimes I don't teach in the numbers that I numbered it, but that's okay. So if we go here up on the source sheet, here we go. I think we'll get a good sense of how the more technical, arbitrary, or perhaps a better word might be associative method might work. Okay, so let's go back to Rav Shimon Bar Yochai in the cave. So Rav Shimon Bar Yochai in the cave, that famous Talmudic story, is in the second parak of Shabbat. But how did it get there? So the Gemara is not about caves at all. Let's see what the Gemara is about. So I'm going to read it in the English again. Let's try to sneak in enough of the original if somebody wants. Okay, here we go. Okay, so I'm reading in the English, but if anybody wants, they could follow along in the original. This question was raised before them. Why does this affliction commence in the bowels and end in the throat? So there's some kind of sickness that Gemara is curious what sin causes it and why does it affect the human being in this particular physical way. Thereupon, Rabbi Yehuda, son of Rabbi Lai, right, the famous Rabbi Yehuda of the Mishnah, the first speaker on all occasions, answered. Now, his answer doesn't really interest us right now, but notice he gets like a title. He gets a status. And in the original, what's he called? Rosh HaMedabrim B'chol Makom. He's the chief speaker. If there's a communal event, Rabbi Yehuda gets the keynote address. So now again, the Gemara was not about caves or Romans or Rabbi Yehuda, but it was discussing something. And Rabbi Yehuda was called the chief speaker. So the Gemara naturally, in the continuation, wants to know, wait, how did he get that position? So let's read a little bit more of the English here. So the Gemara a little bit later says, why is he called the first speaker on all occasions? And then it tells the story. Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon were sitting, and Judah, son of Proselytes, was sitting near them, Yehuda ben Gera. And they start discussing, this is very famous, they start discussing the Romans. What do we think of the Romans? Rabbi Yehuda commenced the discussion by observing how fine are the works of this people. They've made streets, they've made built bridges, they've erected baths. So Rabbi Yehuda says the Romans, they brought civilization. Right, this was a backward place, and the Romans have brought civilization. Those of you who know Monty Python may be having a Life of Brian reference here, but we're going to leave that out. Okay, next. Then Rav Yossi is the middle path. Rav Yossi was silent. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai answered and said, all that they made for themselves. I mean, it's true they brought a certain amount of civilization, but it's really corrupt. They built marketplaces to set harlots in them. Baths to rejuvenate themselves, bridges to levy tolls for them. So it's all self-serving. Okay, now, unfortunately, you know, there are no secrets in this world. So the fourth fellow tells everybody. Now, Judah, the son of Proselytes, went and related their talk, which reached the government. And now, apparently, the Romans did not take criticism very well. So they decreed Yehuda, who exalted us, shall be exalted. Yossi, who was silent, shall be exalted, Tzipori. Apparently, neutrality was not a good option for the Romans, so Yossi gets punished also. Okay, so in the story, of course, Hashem Vachai gets a death sentence from the Romans, and he goes to hide. And that leads to the famous story of him hiding in the cave. I'll just mention one humorous thing. People may not be aware, but he actually hides somewhere else before the cave. He actually first goes to hide in the Beit Midrash, which I often found very odd, because where else would you look for Hashem Vachai? But be that as it may, he goes to hide in the Beit Midrash, then moves on to the cave. And then, of course, you have the famous story. He and his son are in the cave. They're studying Torah. They're davening. They're angry with the world for being engaged in mundane behavior. But let's think for a second. If I ask you, how did the cave story, why did it appear in Masechet Shabbat? It seems that it was purely associative, right? Could we all agree? It seems like it was purely associative thinking. Like, how did it appear there? Well, we needed to explain why Rabbi Yehuda was called Rosh HaMedabrim B'chol Makom. And in the context of that explanation, we discovered, oh, Rabbi Yehuda was speaking about the Romans. The Romans rewarded him. Oh, I should have said this explicitly. And the reward apparently was that he gets to be the keynote speaker. And once we told that story, we end up with a Shema Baruchai in the cave. So I would say that would be an example of what I would call the more technical explanation for placement. Right, we had this great story. It came up through a series of associations. Why is Rabbi Yehuda Rosh HaMedabrim B'chol Makom? Because he praised the Romans. In the same story, Rav Shmuel Yochai criticized the Romans. And lo and behold, we have the cave story. Okay, now I want to do the contrast. I'm going to continue doing it without the source sheet for now, but I think that's okay. So I am not such a Hasidic fellow, but I am a big fan of a Hasidic writer known as Rav Tzadok HaKohen from Lublin. And Rav Tzadok and Lublin like to maximize meaning, maximize significance. In fact, one scholar came up with the term omni-significance, right? Omni-significance means you don't look for technical explanations. You look for explanations that are full of religious meaning. So here is a great example. Rav Tzadok declares that placement is always meaningful. Meaning Chazal, he says very explicitly, if you have the text, because I think it might be on the website, it was placed b'makom ha-ra'ui, in the fitting location, below altzad ha-hizdamin. And it wasn't just a hizdamnut, like an opportunity, that Chazal said, oh, let's find an opportunity and we'll insert good stories. Okay, now Rav Tzadok seems to make this a principle for all of Shas. And I wish he had done more explaining of examples. He actually does about four or five examples where he does it very interestingly. It would be great if you'd done it more. But I will say one thing to kind of drive to a middle position. I think sometimes we make a mistake in life when we think that things are all or nothing. I don't see any reason in a lot of cases why things to be all or nothing. Here, let's try this example. Like I could say, oh, Chazal never had deep meaning. They just looked for a place to insert it. Or I could say they always had some deeper meaning in mind. But why would it have to be one or the other? Okay, why can't we say that, okay, sometimes they had a deeper meaning in mind, and sometimes they just looked for a place to insert this very good story? Again, it doesn't seem to me logically compelling that we have to say it's always one or always the other. But then, I think then the methodology would be, if we see a story, I think the question we should ask ourselves is, do we have a good reason why it is what it is? If we do, wonderful. If we don't, we don't have to. We don't have to force it in there, okay? But that, again, I think we're now set to share up because we've got these two possibilities, that it wasn't a meaningful placement or it truly was. Okay. It thinks I'm not plugged in for some reason. Okay, so now...
Sorry to interrupt. Shani, because you are host, you are actually the only person with power now to make Rabbi Blau host. So if it's not too much trouble, I've actually sent you a couple of steps that you need to follow to do that. I'm so sorry for the inconvenience, but if it is possible, yeah, we would really appreciate it.
I don't know how to be a host. What am I supposed to do?
So you need to go to participants in the bar at the bottom of your screen.
Yeah.
And then you're going to find Yitzhak Blau.
Yes.
And then you're going to click on the little thing that says more.
Yes. Okay. And make host.
Yes. And then click yes to confirm.
Okay.
Oh, Shani, way to go. You are a technological wizard. Excellent.
That is fantastic. You got to thank us for that today.
So now I'm going to do share screen again.
Rabbi Blau?
Yeah.
If I may, could it be that the story is placed, the cave story, because when they come out, they see the person with the two hadassim and he's rushing home for Shabbos?
Oh, terrific. Okay, guys, we have to like graduate Sri Rudolph to some like advanced colo. She keeps saying these great points here. Okay, excellent. So I'm going to go ahead, and I wasn't going to do that right now, but I will do it since she brought it up. Okay, which is, let's say someone wanted to look for deeper meaning. So what might it be? So one model I would say would be, well, what about the chapter? Is the chapter somehow relevant to the theme of the story? And here, I think it's exactly right what you said. Okay, if we think about it, wait, where is this? It's in the second chapter of Shabbat. Now, even if we're not experts in the Talmud, we might know, wait, the second chapter of Shabbat, we recite those Mishnayot on Friday night, right? That's a famous chapter called B'mem Adlikin. And in B'mem Adlikin, that's about getting ready for Shabbos, right? That's what it's about, like lighting candles, that last hour just before Shabbat. So now Suri's point is brilliant, right? I think Jeff Rubenstein makes the same point. So wait, that's why this story is here. It's almost like that association of Rosh HaMedabrim B'chol Makom was actually almost like a red herring. That was just a technical means, but it's not the deeper meaning, right? But arguably, what is a key line in the story? Well, Rashbi and his son are furious with people for being involved in mundane activities, and they're reconciled to the world when this old man is running to prepare for Shabbat with good-smelling hadassim. So maybe really a key theme in the story is that preparation period just before Shabbat. And what better place for the story than the second parak of Masechet Shabbos? It's a very excellent idea. So I think that's a good example of moving.
Thank you.
Right, that's what you meant, right?
No, I just said thank you.
Okay, great. So that's exactly what we mean by moving from the by the way, I should point out, you notice my mother is smiling. So my mother is smiling for two reasons, because a person in the shir made a good comment, and even better for my mother, the person's from Elizabeth, New Jersey. So my mother's very happy now. Okay, so in any case, so that's a great move from the technical associative explanation to a deeper explanation. What I particularly like about that example is that it seems like we have a perfectly good associative explanation. It seems like it just came in to explain Rosh HaMedabrim B'chol Makom, and yet the discerning reader can discover something else. That was excellent. So let's try to work on that a little bit more. Now, in that example, we connected it to the chapter. What if we try to connect it to not just the chapter, but to the whole tractate? So let's try an example. We can look inside.
The light is on.
I'm sorry? Okay. But I think you'll all get this, or many of you will get it, even before we look inside. So we mentioned last week, we mentioned the Kamsa Bar Kamsa story. And indeed, the famous stories about the Churban HaBayit, about the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, appear in a tractate called Gittin, about divorce. So if I wanted to claim, let's say I was adamant and wanted to claim that it's meaningful, the placement. So what would you say? I'm just finding the right source here. Why would Gittin be a good place for a story about divorce? Okay, actually, we'll throw it to the crowd. In fact, you could answer in the chat or just grab the mic for a second. Okay, and when I answer, why it might belong in a tractate about divorce?
It's the cause of the divorce between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and
excellent, Richard. Very good, Richard. Okay, so we know one of the classic metaphors we have in Jewish thought is the metaphor of of all over Chazal. Very clear. Actually, forget it. It's in Tanakh already, right? This kind of imagery. And of course, at that point, a rupture in the relationship could be viewed as some kind of divorce. So indeed, in source 8, which I'm not going to read inside, those of you who want to look at it, right? He says, the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash is some kind of rupture between the Jewish people and God. So there's something divorce-like about it. So maybe stories that relate to that event, that happening, should be in Gittin. Now, to go one step further, it'll be interesting. This might divide those of you with a more Hasidic soul and those with less Hasidic soul. How far you want to push this? But Rav Tzadok then goes on to say, but wait, it's not really a divorce, right? It's a traumatic event, but we don't really believe that God and Am Yisrael will no longer have any kind of interaction. So he says something very clever. He says there are several chapters in Gittin which have the word get or gerushin in the title. But the chapter that this particular text or these stories appear in happens to be a chapter that's title is Hanizakin, damages. And then he says, then once he makes that move, it's obvious where he's going to go. How do damages differ? Well, damages can be compensated for, right? If one has damages, one can pay for them. One can fix what is damaged. So at that point, he says, the Talmud is playing with this in a very interesting way, right? It is on the one hand, a divorce. There's something, a rupture about it, but yet it's not a full-fledged rupture. And therefore, the individual chapter is a chapter about damages where one can compensate and restore. So I just want to sum up what we've done so far, but I think we've done a good job of showing how the more meaningful placement could work. And notice what we've done. We've done meaningful placement in two larger units. Meaningful in the chapter, as Suri would have it, that maybe that's why the cave story is in the second parak of Shabbat with the Shabbat tie-in, and meaningful on a chapter, on a tractate-wide basis. Maybe that's why the Churban, the destruction stories are in a chapter about divorce, in a Masechet about divorce. Okay, let's do one larger unit, and then we'll get to small units. And this is something I actually am very extremely fond of. Okay, and again, it's going to be Rav Tzadok again, but here we go. Let's see the Gemara first. Okay. I'm going to make an argument here that what if we say that an Agadah at the beginning of a tractate might be more telling? Because think about it. You're putting a tractate together and you want to have certain themes. Sometimes you'd highlight a theme by either putting it, I think, at the beginning or at the end. Isn't that what a good author would do? So maybe we should even be more sensitive to which Agadot, which stories or story-like of things begin a tractate. So in Masechet Pesachim, it's very interesting because there's a sugya there that a lot of people skip, but I actually think it's fascinating. Because when people teach Pesachim, people want to talk about, you know, the Karban Pesach, they want to talk about Bittul Chametz, about Bedikar Chametz. So there's a sugya in Daf Gimel that usually gets short shrift. But I really like it because I find language very interesting. And here's what the sugya is about. Okay, those of you in Daf Yomi might remember this. It wants to know, wait, there are different values in discourse. Like one value is be concise. One value is be clear. A third value is be clean. Don't speak coarsely. Don't speak negatively. Now, those are all good values. Again, being concise, being clear, being clean, as it were. But we can all realize they might clash with each other. For example, let's say there's a pasuk that likes to say there's an animal that is a nenu tahar. It is not pure or not kosher. So clearly it would be a lot simpler to say the animal is tamei, right? But what if we say we just don't like to use the word tamei? We'd prefer to say a nenutar, right? Instead of saying someone's stupid, we'll say they're not intelligent. Okay, so that's an example where in theory, the different values might clash, right? You might say, but I could say it in a more refined way, but I'll have more words. So let's just look at this Gemara in Pesachim. Now, I'm just picking out one line to give you a taste. I'm not saying this is the conclusion. So the Gemara says, rather,
wherever... Rabbi, which source are you on?
I'm sorry. Thank you for telling me. I'm in source 6. Okay. My cursor is now on the English, but I want to follow in the original. I'm in source 6. This is the third page of Pesachim. Rather, wherever they are equally convenient, what if it wouldn't be more words? Scripture discourses in a refined language, right? Obviously, why be coarse if you could be more refined? But wherever more words would be required, the shorter phraseology is employed. So I admit this particular line seems to think that being concise is more important. But for our purposes now, which value wins doesn't really matter. We're not so much discussing which value wins as discussing the nature of speech. Okay, great. Now let me throw a question to the crowd before we get to Rav Tzadok. Can anyone think of a reason why, speech, discourse, how to talk to people, that is a good theme for the beginning of Pesachim? Is there something about this holiday, perhaps more than other holidays, that would make me think, now is the time to discuss proper discourse? What are the values we would employ in talking to somebody else, in conveying ideas? Okay, I'll open the floor again. Would like to suggest why Pesachim would be the perfect place for such a conversation.
We have to talk about Yetziat Mitzrayim.
Exactly. Whoever said that, excellent. I would say, wouldn't you all agree that if I compare all the Chagim, the one where discourse is the most significant would be Pesach? I mean, Sukkot is a great holiday. Arba Minim, the Sukkah, who could beat it? But it doesn't really be a sense of conversation, right? You could have a wonderful Sukkot, and in theory, you don't have to really talk about the Chag. There's no, right, obviously you naturally will. There's no concrete mitzvah to do so. Shavuot, the same thing. For the sake of argument, Shabbat, the same thing. Where do we have perhaps the conversation of the ritual year? I would say the Pesach Seder. The Pesach Seder is the conversation, and the Yigat to Levincha, right? Notice that how captivating it is. That even today, so many Jews, even of a more secular variety, they participate in the Pesach Seder. They're part of this ongoing conversation. So at that point, I would suggest, it really belongs here. Okay. And therefore, maybe it's a good start to the Masechet. Right. So I just want to point out, Rav Tzadok in source 7, which I'm not going to read inside, he does point out that it's the beginning of the Masechet. He just goes in a different direction. So he did inspire me to think about the question. He happens to have a different explanation. I'll just show you for 1 second. The Zeu, and the last two lines here, Zeu hatchalat ha-masechta, that's the beginning of the tractate, lohorot inyan ha-mechuvan mi-masechet zu, to show what's really the goal, the intent of this whole tractate. She inyan ha-pesach l'lameid l'shon nikiya. So far it's all like we've said, to speak in a refined way. But then he says, he thinks this is about Jewish lineage. I don't want to get into his topic. Leave it aside for now. But I think we could take his methodology and use the idea we said, right? This is the Chag of discourse. Let's have a opening sugya about how to talk. Okay, so we're now going to move to the second part of this year. But in the first part of this year, I just want to review what we've done so far and see if anyone has a mid-year question. Okay, what we've done so far is talked about a more technical approach. Maybe sometimes it's just an association. There's no deeper reason for the placement. I am open to that. But it might be very satisfying we found a deeper reason. Rav Tzadok is very adamant about finding a deeper reason. We've now done it on 2 levels once again. I would say 3 categories. Category 1 is in the chapter. That was Shabbat. Category 2 is in the tractate. That was Gittin. Category 3 is in the tractate again, but maybe with a special focus on the beginning of the tractate. Okay, special focus, that's going to set the tone, and that was the Pesachim and the nature of discourse. Okay, we're now going to get to part 2. Does anybody have any comments or questions at the end of part 1? Okay, terrific. Let us go to part 2. Again, feel free to write it on the chat if you'd like. Okay, here we go. So we're now going to go, we've been so far. Someone has a question? Yeah?
Is it possible also in the Agadah on the Mitchilat B'nei Me'ayim, the Gomeret Bepeh, that intrinsically it's a metaphor of something expressing something that's deep inside. So something you should keep inside comes out in the Peh. So here we have the 3 different approaches. So there's a kind of, it's intrinsically literary in terms of its metaphor.
Okay, so the truth is, just Chaim, can you just remind me how you relate it to Yehuda?
He's my son.
Oh, okay. So he was in my shir once.
I know.
Okay, great. Please send him my regards. He's a good man. Okay, so in any case, Chaim is raising a very interesting point. I'm unfortunately going to have to leave it aside now, but there might be some very interesting themes running through that entire page of Shabbat. So those of you who are a little inspired about agadic themes, I suggest you might really enjoy it. Read through all of Shabbat 33b and see which running themes you have there. It's really an amazing Gemara. Okay, on every level, it's really interesting Gemara, but unfortunately, in the interest of time, I'm not going to pick up on his point right now, but it is a very good point. Okay, so now Let us go to the adjacent text. Again, instead of situating the Haggadah in the larger unit, the chapter, the tractate, what if I just ask what text came right before it? And realize the text that came right before it could either be a halachic text or a nagadic text. So let's start with nagadic text. Okay, so here, I think a lot of you are going to be happy because we're going to tell a story that always bothered me as a kid. And I realized once I saw this story in context that things could turn around. So many of you know the story when Rabbi Akiva goes away from home to learn. And according to the Gemara, he learns for 12 years. And then he comes back. And what does his wife say? I'd be happy if he went for another 12 years. And he does. And it seems to celebrate, Rabbi Akiva being away from home for 24 years. Now, 24 might be an exaggeration. Maybe it's just a symbol. But still, it seems like he's away for a lot of time. And it always seemed to me as a kid, like, well, what about domestic responsibility? Like, that doesn't matter at all. We're just okay with Rabbi Akiva spending all his time away in yeshiva. It always seemed like a little bit much. But what if I told you that it's part of a series of Gemarot in Ketubot? There's a series of stories, about five different stories about rabbis being away. It's the closing story. But if I looked at all the stories together, I might end up with a very different take on husbands being away for extended periods. So let's take a look again. I am here in source number 4, but I'm going to read it in English. So those of you who want, you could, on the website, I think, follow in the original. Here we go. So we're going to do two stories that precede the Rabbi Akiva story. Here's story 1. Thus, Rav Ruchami, who was frequenting the school of Rabbi at Mechuzah, used to return home on the eve of every day of atonement. So Rav Ruchami was away. Apparently, in the old days, travel wasn't so easy. So his trip home every year from yeshiva was an Erev Yom Kippur. That's when he'd arrive home. I imagine he probably stayed through Sukkot. But that's when he would arrive home, an Erev Yom Kippur. On one occasion, he was so attracted by his subject, right? He was just learning a great topic. It was just too good to pass up that he forgot to return home. So he got very excited. And he just stayed in the yeshiva. His wife was expecting him every moment, saying, he is coming soon. He is coming soon. Okay, now I'm going to go down a little bit. As he did not arrive, she became so depressed that tears began to flow from her eyes. Right? Imagine just the one time all year, her husband comes home and he does not arrive. He was at that moment sitting on a roof. The roof collapsed under him and he was killed. So obviously this is pretty harsh, but I think we can clearly say we have an opposite message here. Okay, we have a message about, there is domestic responsibility. And if you only come home once a year, you better come home that one time. Right? How could it be that you chose to stay in yeshiva and you're not going to be home at all during the course of the year? Okay, so I think at that point already, we have a first story which is negative about the husband being away, or the husband at least makes a mistake. We have the last story of Rabbi Akiva where the Gemara is positive about the husband being away. Now, something I love to teach. Let's look at a middle story. And you'll tell me if the middle story is positive or negative. Because I think, in theory, you could go both ways. I, again, want to give credit. I often feel in life that I'm not such a creative thinker, but I know where to find good material. So there's a fellow named Yona Frankel who kind of brought Agada to university. He was like the first professor of the Agada in Hebrew University. So Yona Frankel has a very interesting reading of this story. So I want to give him credit. We're going to do his reading. Here we go. Middle story. Hanania ben Chachinai was about to go away to the academy towards the conclusion of Rishon Bar Yochai's wedding. Okay, so at that wedding, Rashbi's getting married, and his father of Hanania is eager to get back to yeshiva. Wait for me, the latter said to him, until I'm able to join you. So obviously, Rashbi can't leave. So he says, hold on a little bit. He, however, did not wait for him, but went away alone and spent 12 years at the academy. Rav Hanania could not wait. He runs to yeshiva. He's there for 12 years. By the time he returned, the streets of the town were altered, and he was unable to find the way to his home. So pretty remarkable, right? You wait for 12 years, and there's some construction, like Yerushalayim today. Next thing you know, you don't recognize the way home. You can't get home. Going down to the riverbank and sitting down there, he heard a girl being addressed thus. So let's remember what this fellow's name was. His name was Hanania ben Chachinai. Daughter of Chachinai, oh, daughter of Chachinai, fill up your pitcher and let us go. So that's how he hears a young girl being referred to. It is obvious to him that this girl is ours. See, he almost like makes a Talmudic inference. Oh, that must be my daughter. And he followed her. So now he can get home. When they reached the house, his wife was sitting and sifting flour. She lifted up her eyes, and seeing him was so overcome with joy that she fainted. O Lord of the universe, the husband prayed to him, this poor soul, is this her reward? Now, I'm just going to point out, this is an example where the original would be very helpful. because the English has no way. This is what we always say, guys. There's no such thing as a neutral translation. It's not clear in the Gemara if she dies or faints. Okay, and is she fainted and revived or died and resurrected? But I guess Cencino decided that she fainted. Okay, and then he prays for her. And so he prayed for mercy to be vouchsafed for her, and she revived. Okay, so let's look at this story. Is this positive or negative about Rabbi Hananya ben Chachinai? So I'm going to go with approach that I don't really agree with, but just to toss it out there. Someone could say, well, isn't there a happy ending? What's the big deal? Right, his wife is revived, and now he can live a happy life with his wife and daughter, given all the Torah he learned while away in yeshiva. Okay, those of you who would want to give a more negative or critical reading, which is Frankel's reading, what lines in the Gemara would you point to? Where would you see criticism here, or that things are not so simple? I think you could point to three or four different things. What would you point to here?
His own daughter.
Okay, so first of all, not recognizing your own daughter. But not only that, it's so powerful. Notice how the daughter is referred to. So I think we would all say, what do most people need in their lives? You have, in most home units, most family units, you have the matriarch and the patriarchal figure. So if their two parents are there, which is the normal healthy situation, so dad and mom fill those roles. But if a parent is not there for whatever reason, so a grandparent fills the role. So if mom's not there, grandma's the matriarch. If dad's not there, so grandpa's the patriarch. So notice, she's not even thought of as daughter of Hananya. She's thought of as daughter of Chachinai. I mean, the grandfather's been the one in the house raising her. So I think that already might be quite a subtle critique. So we have, he doesn't recognize his daughter. We have the daughter is referred to as the daughter of Chachinai. Okay, I don't want to throw anything else in there.
At the very beginning, when he's leaving, someone says, hey, wait, I want to come with you. And he rushes off. He says, no, I can't wait for you.
Yes. And notice the guy he's rushing off from is getting married. So again, it's almost like, oh, he doesn't really understand domestic responsibility. Like Hananya is, he's got like his one track mind. Yeshiva. Yeshiva is the greatest place ever. And other things just have to fall by the wayside. I would just add to that. I think the cumulative effect is convincing, but like, feel free to disagree with me. I think it's also telling that he can't find the way home. Right. Maybe that's also kind of a symbol. You know, you can't just leave for 12 years and just go home again. That's not the way life works. So maybe, as it were, the construction symbolizes the difficulty in coming back home again. So I think if you put that all together, in my mind, Yonah Frankel has a pretty convincing argument that this middle story is not really celebrating being away either. Right. That here we have, you know, it's a struggle. It's true that at the end of the day, they don't suffer and that the wife is revived. But his daughter is referred to as the daughter of the grandfather. He doesn't recognize her. He can't get home again. You put it all together and things are really tricky. So now think about what happens. Instead of reading the Rabbi Kiva story in isolation, if I read the Rabbi Kiva story in the larger context, it changes the whole sugya. It tells you that Chazal had a much more nuanced approach to husbands being away. It's not like this rubber stamp that husbands could be away forever and we don't care. In fact, let's go one step further and try to work it out a little bit. Since we have a knowledgeable crowd, so I think some of you probably remember the story. Can anyone tell me why the Rabbi Kiva story might be different? Why we might be more comfortable there with the Rabbi Kiva being away? How does that story differ from the other stories we've seen? Anyone remember how it happens? How Rabbi Kiva ends up going away to yeshiva?
Because his wife wanted him to go.
Terrific. Okay, Alana, very good. Right, couldn't you argue that the whole dynamic is different there? Rabbi Kiva is not eager to run away. His wife wants him to be a scholar, right? If I recall correctly, she even says, I'll marry you on condition that you go learn. So wouldn't it be very different structure if I'm going to make my wife happy, right? She wants to be married to a significant Torah scholar, not to an ignoramus, and therefore I have to go to yeshiva. So maybe if we would put it all together, put the story in the larger Agada context, we now would have a very important message. That there is a clash of values here. We do love Torah study. We also have domestic responsibility. But you'd have more leeway to be away when your spouse is the one pushing you. That would give you more leeway to be away. Okay, great. Okay, so that's the Agada context. Now for the last part of this year, and this might even be the most interesting. I don't know, because I find the whole thing interesting. What happens when it's not an Agada context, but it's a halachic context? Meaning we have a halacha, and then right after the halacha, there's a story. What role could the story play vis-a-vis the halacha? Can it affect the halacha? Can it illuminate something about the halacha? again, just to clarify what we've done here, the first half of the shiur was looking at stories in their larger context. The second half of the shiur is looking in stories in their local context, in their immediate context. What happened just before the story? Okay, so let's go. This you might know because this is also pretty famous, but it might be the most dramatic example of a story affecting the halacha. Okay, so this is Gemara in Megillah about drinking on Purim. All right, let me see. There's a couple of comments in the chat. Let me just glance at them for a second. Let's just see. Okay, Alana Lubin, very good. Good answer. Let me just see the last thing. Ah, Alana Lubin said two good answers I missed, but we already discussed them both in share. Way to go, Alana. Okay, excellent. So let's look at this Gemara in Megillah. Okay, so the Gemara in Megillah says, Rabbah said, it is the duty of a man to mellow himself with wine on Purim. Kind of interesting why Cincino goes with mellow himself, but let's leave that be. Okay, until he cannot, I guess it sounded better than like inebriated or drunk or the like, but okay. Until he cannot tell the difference between cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordechai. Okay, it's a very, very famous quote. Okay, but then there's a famous story that follows. After we have declared the seeming obligation to get inebriated on Purim. Here we go. Rab and Rav Zera joined together in a Purim feast. They became mellow. Okay, this is just great. I have to check if all through the Talmud, Cincino's euphemism for getting drunk is to become mellow. Okay, I have to check that out. Okay, and Rab arose and cut Rav Zera's throat. Okay, so Rab, as it were, shechs Rav Zera, pretty remarkable. On the next day, he prayed in his behalf and revived him. So he brings Rav Zera back to life. Now the Gemara has a little bit of a sense of humor. Next year, he said, will your honor come and we will have the Purim feast together? He replied, a miracle does not take place at every occasion. So Rav Zera says, I think I'll pass this year. I'm going to stay home. Like, who knows what's going to happen? Okay, so you could find it funny, you could not find it funny, but it certainly was a little bit of a humorous line. But is this just adding a little bit of humor, or is it trying to say something about this halacha? So I'm going to give you two possibilities, one less radical and one more radical. The less radical one would be it doesn't affect the halacha. It's just like a caution. Like maybe stories could give you a little bit of a caution about applying halacha. Realize that the application could be really dangerous. And then what would the Gemara be saying? For whatever reason, there is some kind of religious mandate to drink more on Purim. However, realize there's a dangerous game. So do it with caution. Do it with care. And the story is there to caution you. Keep a notice, when in the first version I just said, the story is in no way changing the halacha. It's just telling you about how to apply the halacha. Maybe that's what a story does. A story helps you with the application. But interestingly enough, there's some Rishonim, and this, those who don't like drinking will like this very much. Some Rishonim say, what's the purpose of the story? The purpose of the story is precisely to take a different halachic position. That the story is saying, no, you don't have to get drunk. Despite Rava's desire to get drunk, it's too dangerous. And this story illustrates why you actually should not do so. So notice what we have here. We have a lot of, there's a great tool, the story. The story could reflect on what happens before it in numerous ways. We're going to see even more. We didn't do all of them yet. Okay, one way would be, it's like, oh, be careful. I mean, the halacha doesn't change, but this is a tricky halacha to realize successfully. Or guess what? This story is such a powerful story, it actually has halachic impact. And then there would not be an obligation to drink. Okay, any comments on that before we do one or two more models? Okay, we're good? Okay, wonderful.
So let us you can view this as an example of ma'aseh lestor.
Ah, yafeh.
This is a common phenomena.
Sometimes. Okay, great.
Given the title and sometimes not.
Okay, so that's a very good question. The truth is, okay, so Larry, that was you, right?
Richard, sure.
Oh, Richard, I'm sorry. Okay, so Richard has apparently good Talmudic background. Sometimes you'll have, let's say, the Mishnah will have halakha and then tell a story afterward, and the story seems to be going in a different direction. And the Gemara will often ask, ma'aseh lestor? Right, is this story there to contradict what came before it? So really, Richard, we should do a larger study of that phenomena. But again, I'm going to use the excuse of the time constraints. But you're right, that would be interesting to look at. I also almost have a funny sense that maybe there's a more halachic story and a more agadic story, but I'm going to leave that out for now. Okay, because again, I would say this story seems more agadic in its nature, right? There's something a little bit fantastical about it, you know, Rav Zera being shecht and brought back to life. But even though it's a little bit more agadic, we've still seen how it could impact on the halacha. But Richard, yeah,
that's why I said I said it's almost a maase of a story. Whether you would actually call it a maase is probably.
Richard, that was terrific. I'm sorry, Richard. Just out of curiosity, what's your Gemara background?
I've done some studying.
Okay, well, you've done it well.
I've done Daf Yomi. I've gone through Mishnayot.
Okay, terrific. Richard, keep it up. You're doing a great job, Richard. Okay, so now let us go to source number two. And you'll see here also that the story seems to be a little bit at cross purposes with the halacha. Okay, so the Gemara in Brachot, so again, those of you who want to watch, we're now in source two. We are looking at the English. There's more brachot about when you're in the middle of the Amidah, right? The Amidah is the most significant part of davening, when you're actually standing before God. And what happens if various distractions or dangers come up? So the Mishnah seems rather strict. It says, even if a king greets him, he should not answer him. That sounds pretty remarkable. Like a king greets you, it seems pretty dangerous. No, keep davening. So the Gemara comes, and then here we're in the halachic section, and really tones it down. Rabbi Yosef said this was meant to apply only to Jewish kings, but for a king of another people, he may interrupt. So what do we have here? Presumably, we think it's life-threatening if it's the Roman emperor, right? We've seen that the emperor does not take insults too easily. So who knows what he's going to do? So if it's actually dangerous, you do stop the Amidah. Okay, so some of these people get the wrong idea from the Mishnah. The Mishnah is pretty strict, but if you're actually in a life-threatening situation, you stop the Amidah. Right, and escape the life-threatening situation, or respond to the non-Jewish king. Okay, great. That makes a lot of sense. Now, a little bit later, we get a story. Our rabbis taught, it is related that once when a certain pious man was praying by the roadside, an officer came by and greeted him, and he did not return his greeting. So notice we have an official, and the original word is hegemon, right? Like hegemony, right? The hegemon comes by, and he doesn't answer. So he waited for him till he had finished his prayer. Now the hegemon wants to talk to this Jewish fellow. So he finishes, let's say, mincha. When he had finished his prayer, he said to him, fool, is it not written in your law? Only take heed to thyself and keep thy soul diligently. And it is also written, take ye therefore good heed unto your souls, right? V'nishmartem mod l'nafshotechem. When I greeted you, why do you not return my greeting? By the way, one of the things I love in Shas is how, like, the Roman officials can quote psukim. You got to love that. So the Roman officials, wait, didn't you learn sixth grade? Didn't you learn that life takes precedence? What's going on? How can you keep davening? Here we go. When I greeted you, why did you not return my greeting? If I had cut off your head with my sword, who would have demanded satisfaction for your blood from me? He replied to me, be patient, I'll explain to you. Okay, and then we'll do it very quickly. He went on, you had been standing for an earthly king and your friend had come and given you a greeting. Would you have returned it? No, you're blind. So I'll just summarize the rest. So this pious fellow, right, we told he was a chassid, okay, that this chassid says, wait, if I was talking to the king and my buddy came by, I wouldn't interrupt it. So here I'm talking to the king of kings. So all the more so, I should not interrupt. Okay, but let's ask the obvious question. That's a very nice story, and don't interrupt the king of kings. You wouldn't interrupt a human king. But how does that change the fact that this story seems to contradict the halacha? Right? The halacha said a few lines above was that if it's a non-Jewish king and it's dangerous, you should indeed stop your Amidah and respond. So how come this pious fellow chooses the route of, no, I'll finish my Amidah and then I'll talk to the guy? Okay, so before I say what I saw in one scholar, which I liked a lot, okay, does anyone make a suggestion? How can we have this story, which again seems in sharp opposition to the halacha just above it? What would you guys like to say? Is there a way to reconcile this story with the preceding halacha? Or do we have to say, no, we're here again, we're kind of almost, we're arguing with halacha. Okay, yeah? All right, let's see the chat. Maybe someone's answered in the chat. Ah, okay. We lost Suri. Okay. All right, so I'm going to tell what I've seen. Okay, and then people can give other suggestions if they want. Okay, so there is a young scholar named Yonatan Feintuch, Tani Feintuch, very, very nice fellow. He wrote a really good book in Agadah. Like, thank God, I told you last week that for a long time, Agadah was kind of like an ignored field. And now, like, good people are putting their attention to it. Okay, I mentioned Jeffrey Rubenstein has some nice books. This fellow Tani Feintuch has some very nice books. So Tani wants to suggest as follows. Notice how this fellow is referred to. He's referred to as a chassid. chassid, not always, but sometimes relates to what we would call midat chassidut, an extra level of piety. Now, if Tani's pshat is going to work, it might depend on another question. So let me just raise one other question. I'll tell Tani's pshat, and then we'll summarize the whole shiur. Okay, here's my question. Okay, we know that in Judaism, we really value life. We value life greatly. But there are individual cases that call for martyrdom. And they're kind of limited. But what if someone says, I care about this halachic value so much, I want to be a martyr even when it's not demanded. Let's say we have someone in this chat right now, in this Zoom, who really loves Shabbos. And they just say, I can't imagine ever being Chal Shabbos. And maybe even if at gunpoint, they say, I want to voluntarily choose to be a martyr. So the Rambam, many of you I think will like this, the Rambam says nothing doing, right? When we say you don't have to be a martyr, we're not saying you don't have to be a martyr. We're saying you have to choose life. So in the Rambam, there's no gray, meaning either you choose martyrdom or you have to stay alive. You have to do the Avera. However, I want to be intellectually honest, even though I'm drawn to the Rambam. Some Rishonim did not think so. Some Rishonim said there is a category of voluntary martyrdom, that you could say this mitzvah is so important to me and I feel need to stand up for Judaism that I'm going to be a martyr, even though it's not, let's say, you know, idolatry, murder, or sexual immorality. Okay, now what if I go with that latter approach? Maybe that means that there's another category where a chassid could say, I realize I don't have to do this, but I'd like to do this. So if that's correct, so let's go back to Tani Feindach. So what does he want to claim? What if this story is setting up another model? Now notice, it's different than my two previous categories, because we're not, on the one hand, arguing with the halacha, nor are we even saying, be careful in applying the halacha. We're saying a third thing. Realize that there's another model out there, right? That this mainstream halacha, of course, would be, you have to interrupt your amidah to answer a king, right? You have no right to do something dangerous when it could be really life-threatening. But guess what? Maybe according to some opinions, there's another option, that someone who wants to take on the mantle of extra piety, they can, in fact, take the risk of finishing their Amidah and then explaining to the non-Jewish official why they did so. Now, again, some of you might not like that here because it has to do with loss of life, but I think it's a model you could, in theory, apply elsewhere. Like, I think often in life you might have, okay, this is the mainstream halacha, but there is a midat chasidut to do something else. So let me just think if I should sneak in one more thing or do a summary. You know, let me summarize the entire thing. We'll see if anybody has closing questions. But again, hopefully I've shown you again how many subtle tools Agada has. Right? It's really remarkable. And I think we should all put more efforts into being better readers of Agada. We saw last week how even a number or a name could be full of meaning. And now we're seeing even a question of just where the story appears. Does it appear here or does it appear somewhere else? That could also matter. And just to sum up, we started up, and let me just say again, I'm not committed to the Rav Tzadok position. I'm not committed that it's always meaningful. Because I think if we're committed to it always being meaningful, we're going to have a lot of forced interpretations. So I'd be careful there. Maybe sometimes it was just happened to be there. But the fact that sometimes it's happenstance doesn't mean it's always happenstance. And maybe quite frequently it's meaningful. And again, here are the models. One model is, it really fits the chapter. As Suri said very well, a story that highlights getting ready just before Shabbat, what better place than the second parak of Masechet Shabbat? Sometimes it fits the tractate beautifully. Oh, a story about destroying the Beit HaMikdash? That's a rupture in the marriage relationship between God and Am Yisrael. That belongs in a tractate about divorce. That belongs in Gittin, as Rav Tzadok explains. Okay, thirdly, what about, we'll put something in the beginning of the tractate to set the tone. Psachim is the chag of discourse, is the chag of telling the story of Sibri Yetzia Mitzrayim. Let's begin with a whole discussion of correct discourse. What are the values? Being concise, being clear, being refined. What a great way to start before we get to this tractate. Okay, so there we have the chapter and the tractate. Next, what if I ask, I don't have to have such a wide lens. Let me cast a narrow lens. How does this story impact on the adjacent material, the preceding material? So if it's an agada versus an agada, maybe the stories are playing off each other. So we saw the great example in Ketubot. We have the famous Rabbi Kiva story, celebrating him being away from home in yeshiva. But we saw that other stories set a different tone. Rav Ruchami unfortunately dies as a result of his not coming home. And even in the Hananiah ben Chachinai story, where there is, as it were, a happy ending, I think many of you agreed with me that there's an implicit criticism in the story. He doesn't know, recognize his daughter. His daughter's called by the grandfather. So if we put all the stories together, we say, wait, these stories are meant to be read in tandem, right? That we do value going to yeshiva, but we also very much value domestic responsibility. And that has to be balanced in a very deep way. It's not that there's an easy winner in that clash. Okay, so that would be how the story could connect to adjacent stories. Finally, we asked, well, how could the story connect to adjacent halachot? And we've seen three models, and I suggest there might be more out there. It's worth you thinking about. One model, the most radical, is the story actually comes to fight with the halacha. That the halacha was, you get drunk on Purim, comes along the story and says, no, you don't get drunk on Purim. It's a bad idea. Okay, that would be the most radical one. You could have toned down versions. Maybe the story comes to tell you, oh, it's still a halacha, but treat it with caution. Treat it with kid gloves, right? This is a big deal, right? Don't get drunk without really being careful about how you do so. So maybe it's like a caution about how to apply the halacha. And then we had a third model in Brachot. We said maybe it's a midat chasidut. Maybe it's another way to treat this halacha, but it doesn't change the mainstream halacha. So notice what we've done here, right? We have this remarkable thing that stories and where they're placed is an incredibly versatile tool. It could do all kinds of things to shed light on Agadah, shed light on Halakha, fit the larger theme of the chapter, fit the larger theme of the tractate. So I'll take closing comments, but I'll just say with this, it seems to me what would be a good methodology at this point, and this is what I try to do. When I see a story, I ask myself, can I fit it in to the larger theme? Sometimes the answer is yes, it's great. Sometimes the answer is no. And at that point, I kind of step back and think, I am not going to come up with some, you know, forced interpretation to tell you how it has to fit in. Maybe just the story happened to be somewhere, but at least I think it's good to always ask that question first, right? Can I link it to something in the Masechet or in the Perek or in the preceding sugya? Okay, anybody with a closing comment or question on this idea of a Agadic placement being meaningful and the different ways that the Talmud might use it to convey meaning? Anyone have a comment on this?
So I had one, maybe it's too far afield, but the passage about the Romans building all these things for their own benefit appears elsewhere. At the end of days, at the heavenly court, the nations are called in.
Amazing.
The Romans come first, and they make this claim for themselves. And then there's the rebuttal, which is the rebuttal here. And then they move on to other nations coming in. But okay, Somehow the same thing is being used in a different
place. That's terrific.
For a totally different purpose in a way. And I don't know how that could play into your...
Richard, I'm really glad you brought that up. Okay. By the way, Richard's making me feel good because sometimes people claim that those who learn Daf Yomi don't remember the material. Richard is disproving it as we speak, that people who learn Daf Yomi do remember. So he made a very good.
I remember where it appears.
Okay, it's in Avodah Zarah.
Yeah, okay, right. That's it, yeah.
Okay, but Richard's made a very good point. If I'm right, if a story appears twice, maybe it'll change based on its context. Yeah. It's no longer the same story. That is a brilliant point. So, Richard, you just gave an example of a story that appears twice in the Talmud Bavli. That was a very good example. But I'm just going to mention, sometimes you have a story both in the Bavli and Yerushalmi, and it's not in the same tractate at all. And some scholars have written about this, that the story changes based on where it appears. So I'm going to take your point and say, instead of it almost being a question on the approach I'm taking here, I would say it could enhance the approach I'm taking. That indeed, maybe when Chazal place it in Avodah Zarah, they're doing something different than when they place it in Shabbat. You know, I'll even try, I'll toss one thing out there, but Richard, really great point. Okay, and here again, this is not Bavli Shami, this is two Bavlis. But what if I suggest as follows? Avodah Zarah is about Jews, so to speak, versus the pagans, as opposed to pagans. Maybe the story in Shabbat is not so much about attitude to non-Jewish cultures. That's not what it's doing. That's kind of a byproduct. But in Avodah Zarah, it's more about why we're somewhat negative about paganism. So I would say the same story could be supple and used in different ways. Now, again, you really want to look up the Gemara in Avodah Zarah to see if my approach works. But Richard, I think your point is great. Like, based on what we're saying here, the same story could do double duty, depending on what context it appears in. Did you want to make a second point also?
No, I think I wasn't suggesting this. I was suggesting not that it was a counterexample, but that it's another thing that you have to look at.
Yeah, you know, I think what you're saying
and
is
I
great.
Think you're certainly right that in Avodah Zarah it appears because there's this whole series and that are each nation makes claims for itself, which are rejected, and the Jews are left in the proper position at the end.
Okay.
So that's certainly what happens there.
Great. Let me just make one more point. Maybe we'll close with this. This would actually help. Richard, do you remember where in the Masechet it is? What stage that story appears?
No.
Okay, so it's towards the very beginning. And again, I think that might support what I said about the Pesachim example.
Yeah.
That you might want to set the tone at the start.
Right, it sets the tone.
So if Avodah Zarah is about Jews and pagans, Judaism and paganism, so maybe this story about the Romans really belongs there. So I think Richard's done a great job of supporting this whole shiur, that the same story could take on different meaning in a different context in Avodah Zarah, and the idea that the beginning is a great place to set the tone. Richard, thanks so much for your comments.
You mentioned at one point the beginning, and you followed up examples, but of course the end of a Masechet is typically a Gadata.
Okay, correct.
Very
correct.
Common. And
correct.
So,
but I'm going to leave that aside for now, though you're correct. Okay, anybody
Rabbi,
else? Chaim, go ahead.
I have you stimulated me to pull my Jastrow and to look up the word libisume.
Mm-hmm.
Because was it mellow and what is the real? Because I've always wondered what that word meant.
Okay.
It means, on the one hand, sweet, pleasant, well seasoned, but it can also mean wine turning to vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
And the sense, so the point here is from a literary point of view, the choice of words sometimes can be very powerful.
Absolutely.
Wine on one hand, to maybe get you out of black and white thinking, Oruhaman, Baruch Mordechai. On the other hand, wine can turn into vinegar. And, you know, all the kids that think to drink yourself under the table on Purim is a Yaharet Val Yavor. In point of fact, this is a marvelous example of where wine can turn into vinegar.
Okay. Yes, so first of all, Chaim, that was a great point. Although I'm still not sure that mellow is the most obvious translation, but that was a very good point, though.
It's not so much mellow as sweet and pleasant.
Okay.
Wine is a spectrum.
Fair enough.
I think
it should make you do terrible things.
Got it. Okay.
I think historically, linguistically, it's connected with the fact that they used to perfume they put spices in their wine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Rabbi.
I like this. We have an intellectually curious group. You're even interested in the etymology of Besume. What a group. Okay. So I'm going to go in 1 minute. Maybe one last question.
Rabbi, the Talmud, though, will tell us sometimes what its opinion is without necessarily needing to speculate. So when you're doing the Rashbi, they tell you afterwards, Harbea suid this way and didn't succeed. So you don't, so why, when it really wants an unambiguous explanation, it will give us one.
Look, I agree with that. I would just say sometimes it's explicit and sometimes it's subtle. I think it's hard to argue that it's always explicit. I would say the same about Tanakh also, by the way. Sometimes Tanakh.
No, but when it's important to them, they will give you the explicit.
All right. Fair enough. All right. I thoroughly enjoyed this once again. I'm sorry my computer had a brief blackout, but I think we had a good cheer nonetheless. So everybody should have a good week. And I'm trying to remember when we picked this up. Not next week because it's Erev Tisha B'Av, right? Does anyone remember when the third cheer is? All right. I'm sure you'll hear from Torah in Motion when the third cheer is. Okay. But everybody should be well. I look forward. I'm sorry. When is it?
I think it's August 2nd, the following Wednesday.
Okay. Great. Thanks very much. Okay. Look forward to being in touch.
Okay. Thank you. Great shoot.